This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. If you are listening to this program, you're probably quite the news buff. You like to keep up with what's happening in the world. Well, there were a lot of big stories that dominated the news cycle this last week with the release of the Panama Papers, the ongoing investigations on Islamic State activity in Europe, more drama unfolding in the American presidential race. But as we undertake this survey of important events from this past week, we're going to bring a different set of headlines to you, quite a lot of news that you probably didn't hear about. We have our panel of Trumpet writers here to discuss these things. Here in the studio, we have Robert Morley.
Hi, good to be here. Thanks for having me. Today, we'll discuss the latest oil casualty, and it's a country, and what happens when a nation that relies upon oil for 40% of its government spending suddenly doesn't have it.
We also have Andrew Miller.
Good to be here. Today, we'll be talking about religious liberty in Russia, or rather the lack thereof, and also about attempts to militarize the Arctic Ocean.
We have via Skype from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
War is on the brink of breaking out in a very strategically important piece of territory with three world powers closely involved in the potential conflict.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Nachtigall.
Hello, I'm going to be talking about another large shipment of arms that was found off the coast of Yemen this past week, and I bet you cannot guess who sent the shipment.
All right, we're going to start by talking about a referendum that took place in the Netherlands. There, Dutch voters had an opportunity to weigh in on an association agreement between the European Union and Ukraine, and 61% of Dutch voters said, no, we do not want closer links with Ukraine. Again, with actual warfare taking place in so many locations around the world, so much sensational news gobbling up space on the front page, this is hardly the type of event that gets a whole lot of attention. But to explain the significance of what happened here and what it tells you about the current state of the European Union, we will turn to Richard.
Yes, the Dutch vote left the EU looking pretty ridiculous this week, which is hardly unusual, but important to look at as we look at the future of that bloc. Now, to get a good picture of what happened here, I think we need to go and look at the background of this agreement with Ukraine that the Dutch voters just rejected. So back in 2013, the EU was pursuing these association agreements with Eastern European countries, and the aim was to shift these countries into the EU's orbit and away from Russia. Ukraine looked like they were ready to sign one of these association agreements with the EU. Vladimir Putin didn't like it, so he persuaded the then Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych, to pull out at the last minute and not to sign. The Ukrainian people didn't like being ruled by Putin. That was kind of the final straw. They rose up, they overthrew Yanukovych. Russia retaliated by invading Crimea and eastern Ukraine. So this whole chain of events was kicked off in a lot of ways by this association agreement. It played a very important role in triggering one of the most important geopolitical events in recent years. Now, and we've got the new Ukrainian government. They were very keen to sign this association agreement. And then this week, the Netherlands came along and put a big spanner in the works. In 2015, they passed a law that states that if enough people sign a petition, they need to hold a referendum on the law that they signed a petition against. So this happened with the Ukrainian trade agreement, the first time that that law was put into effect. It is an EU agreement, but every single EU nation has to ratify it. And so then on Wednesday, the Dutch voted to reject it. And so that puts the EU in a tough situation. The referendum isn't completely binding. It suspends the law, but the government could hold another vote in parliament and then push on regardless of the referendum. But of course, that would be very unpopular. In this climate that's building in Europe with the people feeling not listened to by the elites, it would just add to that resentment and that, you know, that kind of anger that's fueling the rise of fringe parties over there. I imagine probably the EU will still end up ignoring the Dutch referendum. They're quite good at finding ways to do that. They'll put some kind of token amendment to the agreement and pretend that the Dutch have got their way. I mean, we know the EU is not very democratic, but what I want to focus on here is just how this whole situation really proves that the EU cannot be both an effective institution and one that's democratic, at least democratic for nation states. I mean, I'm not even sure how one nation could have a coherent foreign policy when individual decisions can be challenged by direct democracy. I mean, historically, we're used to representative democracy, which is quite different, and this kind of thing would have really hurt the U.S. and Britain, I think, in the past.
Yeah, or if, say, in the United States, if individual states had veto power over foreign policy decisions.
Right, that takes it even further. I think just the idea that even the United States could hold a referendum on foreign policy decisions would mean that you'd have American foreign policy careening one way and then the other. But that's right, once you add in the fact that it's not the whole of the EU, it's one individual state, and it suddenly makes the whole thing very unworkable. I mean, what other nation is going to go through what Ukraine has gone through and say, okay, we want to side with the EU, we're going to go side with this trade agreement?
Right, and really putting themselves in harm's way with respect to Russia in doing so. I mean, by taking this stand, they're really kind of putting themselves in Putin's target.
Exactly. They took big risks to kind of side with the EU. And now who would do that if two, three years down the line, Luxembourg might pass a new law and put a big question mark over the whole thing? And yep. So it just shows, it shows the way the EU is working or is trying to work now just isn't working. And it shows that if the EU is going to be a super state, if it's going to have a coherent foreign policy, if it's going to have a major role in the world that can be counted on, if it's going to have plans that it can... you know, that it can plan forward and aims that it can pursue 2-3 years in advance, it can't have the nation state democracies that it has today. It can't allow the Dutch, the French, Spanish, English voters to have a say in how the whole thing is run. It has to be this kind of monolith that rules over these local populations. And that's the only way that it can work. And that's the direction that things like this Dutch referendum are pushing the EU. You know, it's going to make the leaders think, we can't go on like this. We've got to change, and we've got to change in a way that overrules democracy.
Yeah, we put together a digest of news every week called the Trumpet Weekly, and there were several other articles in this week's edition showing just how much the EU is changing, how much, like you mentioned, the climate within the EU is moving toward, a more anti-establishment and more nationalistic and also more aggressive and militaristic a kind of a mindset. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that before we move forward.
Right, the Dutch referendum, this story, it's part of that whole related trend. You know, when it comes to foreign policy, Ukraine and Russia, and dealing with those, the EU cannot be an effective power the way it is. And the same is the case for dealing with the migrant crisis, dealing with terrorists. And we're already seeing the early stages and the early signs of this transformation. So we had an article in the Trumpet Weekly from Ross Douthat called A Transatlantic Role Reversal. And he points out that a few years ago, Robert Kagan said Americans are from Mars, Europeans are from Venus. And it was very clear to see why he said that. America was the one that wanted to go into Iraq. Europe wanted to hold back. He talked about how Europe basically believed in this Kantian dream of perpetual peace, while America didn't. And now he says it's too soon to say Europeans are actually from Mars once again, but the continent's Venusian idol has taken blow after blow. The Euro crisis, the aggression of Vladimir Putin, now the convergence of mass migration and Islamic terrorism, nationalism is returning, border fences are going up. And he just goes on to show how these crises are triggering this change, not just in... it's not a superficial change, it's a deep change in the way society functions, a deep change in how aggressive the nation is, the bloc as a whole is. And then Reuters had a similar article called Germany Can Take That Smug Look Off Its Face. And it was talking about, or it referenced quite a few different articles in the German press, mainly from Spiegel, about the rise of the fringe, about this upswelling of anger. I think the stat that really stood out to me from this article is it said a poll by Spiegel found that 57% of Germans agreed with the statement, those guys up there will do whatever they want anyway, and my opinion doesn't count. Mm-hmm. So basically 60% of Germans believe their democracy is not functioning, that it cannot continue to function the way it is, that they're not being served by their leaders. And so Europe has changed a lot, but then there's also just this a lot of tension that's building to an even bigger change in the future.
fascinating to watch. Stephen Fleury covered that issue on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this morning. It's worth going and taking a listen to that for further coverage of that development. We appreciate that, Richard. One of the big geopolitical moves that is provoking this kind of change among Europeans is happening in Russia. We have another under-the-radar story involving a court case that's underway in southern Russia, a man who faces up to a year in prison for a pretty unusual crime. On a social media post, he insulted the feelings of religious believers. Of course, during the years of the Soviet Union, this was a famously atheistic nation, but that has seriously changed. And to tell us about that, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, as you mentioned, this is really a huge just change for Russia, like almost 180 switch in some ways in their ideologies, and that during the Soviet Union, Russia was officially an atheist state, and you could be persecuted for publicly espousing religion. Now, after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1997, they didn't collapse in 1997, but a few years after it collapsed in 1997, they officially became a secularist state who's supposed to be espousing religious liberty. But that only lasted for a couple years before really the Russian Orthodox Church has just about replaced the Communist Party as this ideological glue that's holding Putin's empire together. As you mentioned earlier, this the man in question in this court case, he was on social media and he'd been writing about how religion was based on Jewish fairy tales and then kind of ended his rant with "there is no God." And then had a Russian Orthodox believer read his post and report him to the authorities. The police showed up one day and took him down to a psychiatric ward. He was subject to about a month of a psychiatric evaluation just to make sure that he wasn't a lunatic or crazy. And then after they determined he was of sound mind, they charged him under Russian law, making it illegal to insult the feelings of religious believers. And if the court case comes down in favor of the prosecutor, he'll face up to a year in prison for writing the phrase "there is no God" on Russian social media.
So what does this tell us about Putin's Russia today? You were saying that the Russian Orthodox Church has become the glue that's holding this state together in a sense and providing the ideological orientation for the power of the state.
Right. Well, Putin does attend Russian Orthodox services, so he's presumably a member of the Russian Orthodox Church. The current head of the Russian Orthodox Church is actually an old friend of his from before the fall of the Soviet Union, and especially since the 2012 election, he's been really catering to the Russian Orthodox Church and their stances against homosexuality, against atheism, or against anyone who speaks out against the church. And in return, they're actually, preaching sermons, making it or like almost a religious duty to support the Putin government.
So we have mentioned this in previous programs that Vladimir Putin is essentially tapping into the power that religion tends to provide in uniting people behind non-religious causes.
Yeah, he definitely sees that power. There is actually a Putin quote one time where he said that anyone who doesn't miss the Soviet Union has no heart. Anyone who wants it back has no brain. And basically, that's the thought. Like he said, emotionally, he said, I miss the Soviet times. But logically, I know there were things about that system that didn't work. It collapsed for a reason. And so he's made economic reforms to try to make Russia a little more economically robust than it was under communism. But he's also realized that atheism isn't very inspiring. So that if he can actually get a church, which was actually historically more in line, after the Turks sacked the Byzantine Empire, the center of the Russian Orthodox Church moved to Moscow. They're the biggest Russian Orthodox nation in the world. And so he's tapping into the traditions of the Byzantine emperors and even the previous czars from before the Soviet Union, realized that we've got like 1,000 years of history in Russia using the Orthodox Church to unite people and only about 80 years of history using atheism to do it. Mm-hmm. So he's wanting to go back to the old way of bringing these countries together. And even in countries like Ukraine, or we'll talk a little bit later in the program about Azerbaijan, but Armenia, they're also very staunch Russian or at least Orthodox nations, that he's using that connection to even try to pull them into his sphere of influence.
It's difficult to see how the religious nature of the Russian Empire will really play a huge role in terms of coloring what Russia does moving forward, but it certainly is interesting to watch how much religion is making a resurgence in modern geopolitics. It's certainly playing the largest role within what we see coming out of the Middle East. We're expecting more of that role to emerge within Europe, and really a conflict, Crusades-level conflict between Islam and Catholicism, but for religion to also be a factor in the rise of what's happening in Asia, it's an interesting counterpart to what you see in those other areas. Well, thanks for that story, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. We turn now to a story out of the Middle East. One of the strongest Islamist organizations in Israel, Hamas, is facing a pretty interesting dilemma. It's a challenge to their founding relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood. And for this story, we'll turn to Brent in Jerusalem.
Yeah, Hamas obviously is the terrorist organization that rules over the Gaza Strip there on the Mediterranean coast in southern Israel. And it's important for people to know that it also has another border with another country, not Israel, that being Egypt. And throughout Hamas's domination of the Gaza Strip, a lot of their food, a lot of their economic gain, and a lot of their trade came through this border with Egypt once Israel closed down the border that led into Israel proper. Now, it's been the lifeline of Hamas to continue its terror-supporting ways. It's also been a lifeline of the people inside the Gaza Strip as well. There's over 1 million people there, and they live from this border being open between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. So right now we have a government inside Egypt that does not like the Muslim Brotherhood and does not like Hamas. Hamas, of course, came out of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in 1987. So what they've done is they've closed off all the border entrances, border crossings, between Egypt and the Gaza Strip, but then they've also destroyed all these smuggling tunnels as well. There was thousands of these things, literally thousands of these tunnels that used to go from Egyptian territory into the Gaza Strip. And what they've done is the Egyptian government under El-Sisi have destroyed a lot of these tunnels. They've dug a huge moat, if you like. It's almost a kilometer wide inside the Egyptian border, destroying their own houses, paying people a lot of money to relocate so that they can ensure that no more tunnels have been built to give Hamas access to Egypt, be it to infiltrate Egypt with their terrorists or to smuggle in goods. And what that effectively has done has cut off the Gaza Strip from the rest of the world. And Hamas, the leadership of the Gaza Strip, is really, really feeling the pinch from that.
So we tracked these relationships that were so strong between Hamas and Egypt and Hamas and Iran. And we've been watching the Hamas-Iran relationship fracture over the last few years. Somewhat surprisingly, except unless if you know about Bible prophecy and the fact that we were expecting a separation between those two at some point. But the alignment between Egypt and Iran is another relationship that we're looking for at some point. So to have this severance of ties between Egypt and Hamas, it's kind of interesting to look at in that perspective.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's why we've got it in the Trumpet Weekly, is just to make people aware that we have been talking a lot about in the past about how the Muslim Brotherhood is going to gain control of Egyptian politics in the future, and that they will
some kind of Iranian aligned government,
some type of Iranian aligned government. But we did see a precursor to that when Mohammad Morsi came into power in 2011 from the Muslim Brotherhood, and Iranian relations were the best they've ever been between Egypt and at that point and Iran. And at that time, Hamas supported what was going on as well, of course, with the Muslim Brotherhood and Iran. And yet from Bible prophecy, we see that those in the Gaza Strip, probably Hamas and Egypt, are going to be on two contrary sides or two different alliances. So there's going to have to be a break there. Now, we looking forward, we probably expect the Muslim Brotherhood to come into power. At least I believe that's what we think might happen inside Egypt. But we aren't going to see Hamas or whoever controls the Gaza Strip at that time follow suit. We're not going to see them align with Iran. So I think it necessitates, that prophecy necessitated a fracture that we're seeing right now between Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood as forced by the current government in Egypt.
Well, it does make you wonder whether the Muslim Brotherhood might be less of a player within Egypt going forward. We're really looking for that alliance between Iran and Egypt to develop, and there certainly is a fair amount of sympathy among the Egyptian populace for that more radical ideology that would maybe be more aligned with Iran. But whether or not it bears the stamp of Muslim Brotherhood, you do wonder, because certainly Muslim Brotherhood came into power, you would expect that there would be more support for Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and maybe that isn't the direction that it would go.
Right, that might be the case. You might see other radicals take over in Egypt, which could definitely happen. I tend to think the relationship that Hamas is going to have to build with other nations, because it doesn't have the support of the Muslim Brotherhood anymore, they might become so strong that regardless, if the Muslim Brotherhood comes back into power, that bridge will be burnt.
So that is definitely one thing that we can watch for, is what does Hamas do? Who do they form relationships with, given the severance of ties with the Muslim Brotherhood? They're certainly in a tight spot right now, and you would expect that they would have to reach out to somebody.
Got to bail them out, and we do expect them to turn to the Gulf states most likely for that help.
Thanks for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. One more story before the break. We were talking about the Egyptian Gaza Strip border. Right now, there's a whole lot of focus in America on the immigration issue and the need to shore up our southern border. And one thing that doesn't get talked about a whole lot is why all these people are so eager to flood across that border. But there's a lot of evidence of just what a failing and failed state Mexico is. Some news that came out this week revealing one more aspect of this story. And for this, we'll go to Robert.
This week, Moody's Investor Service came out and issued some downgrades for both Mexico and Mexico's state-owned oil producer. And this is getting a lot of headlines because Mexico is incredibly dependent on its oil exports for revenue. The government of Mexico, approximately 40% of government spending in Mexico is financed by their state-owned oil producer. But Moody's came out this week and said that Pemex, that's the company, they are on the edge of failure. They slashed their credit rating three notches down to one step above junk. I think some people think that they kept it above junk for political reasons. So here we have a giant oil producer, one of the bigger oil producers in the world, that for the past 13 straight quarters has bled money. It's been losing money for more than the past 3 years in a row. And this company is having to borrow increasing amounts of money to keep operations going. In this Moody's report, they said that the company now has $114 billion worth of assets, but $180 billion worth of liabilities. And everybody knows those liabilities, that's what they owe. That's known. But their assets, well, that's really up for debate. And a lot of people think that those assets are probably a lot lower than that. Those assets would be like old oil field equipment, drilling rigs, oil fields that were once worth something, but now in an age of $35 a barrel oil might be worth nothing. So we have this massively leveraged company that the state of Mexico, the nation of Mexico, has been relying on for 40% of its revenues. It's been relying on this oil company for the past 75 years to finance its government. And that revenue source, they're saying, could be disappearing. And the only reason it's able to pay out money right now is because it's borrowing money to pay out money to the government. So this has a lot of implications for the Mexican economy, and not only the Mexican economy, but the United States itself.
Well, yeah, let's talk about this. Put it in the bigger context. We've covered many of the problems that are besieging Mexico and that are really turning this nation into a set of enclaves of separate governments within, because the Mexican government isn't able to control the state. If they're losing this kind of revenue, help us to understand what happens to Mexico as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. So Moody's downgrading the Mexican government and Pemex didn't occur in a vacuum. Moody's also downgraded a whole lot of other institutions within Mexico. They downgraded 22 Mexican states, 42 municipalities, 8 government institutions, 4 mega corporations, these 4 huge corporations that control so much of Mexico's economy. They downgraded the 4 national development banks, a whole bunch of host of other banks that do business in Mexico that are highly dependent on Mexico. So they took the whole swath of the Mexican economy and said, this is in big trouble. So implications from that. Well, Mexico is the United States' is, I think, fourth most important trade partner, third or fourth most important trade partner. So there's a lot of economic activity that flows back and forth across this border. But the question is, what happens to the 120 million Mexicans if their economy starts falling apart? And that is what it's facing. That is what Mexico is facing right now, at least according to Moody's Investor Service. And in terms of, you mentioned at the top about, you know, walls being constructed, walls in Gaza and in Egypt, those walls exist to prevent people from moving back and forth. Well, over these next several years, there's going to be a lot of attention drawn to America's southern border, because in those kind of conditions, we will see those push factors that cause people to want to migrate. And where will poor Mexicans who are out of work, who no longer are getting the government subsidies because the government can't afford it, where are they going to go? Well, they will be heading north.
Or living in towns that are basically controlled by drug cartels because local law enforcement is totally incapable of keeping a lid on them.
Well, not even local law enforcement. You're absolutely right about that. But it's been the national government, the federal government in Mexico. If you recall, a few years ago, they brought in the army to start combating the drug cartels. The police forces could not do it, so Mexico brought in the military to do policing to do policing activities inside Mexico. And all of that is at risk when 40% of your revenues potentially starts drying up. And the problem Mexico has is so much of its debt is denominated in foreign currencies, meaning the money they borrowed has to be paid back in euros or dollars. So if they want to print pesos to pay for that, they can't do it. They can print as much as they want, and all that's going to lead to is massive inflation. And this is exactly what has happened in Argentina. This is what's happening today in Venezuela. And Mexico could be the next Latin American country that's looking at those conditions. I think Moody's compared it to I think it was an article published by Wolf Richter at his Wolf Street website, comparing it to Mexico today to the tequila crisis back in, I think it was in the 90s, when Mexico's peso went, you know, up into the thousands of pesos needed to buy a dollar. And that could be the type of situation that Mexico is facing again.
A lot of trouble for the people of Mexico. Also, as you said, huge implications for Americans to have a collapsing and failed state right on our southern border, and the kinds of implications that would have in terms of spillover effect into the United States, not just in terms of immigrants who are seeking better fortunes for themselves north, but even for those criminal elements that would take advantage of those kinds of problems.
You're right. The cartels already in Mexico, if you look at what's going on in Colorado with their marijuana laws, the legalization of marijuana, a lot of advocates thought this would lead to, you know, a lot less of criminal activity because everything's legal. What they're finding is the Mexican cartels have moved into Colorado. And I think that we'll just see the cartels know where the money is, and that's north of the border. And any of those kind of pressures is going to keep pushing them further north.
Thanks for that, Robert. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about warfare that broke out in a small but very important part of the Strategic Caucasus, a huge load of arms that was confiscated en route to Yemen, a crisis in student loan repayment, and a battle for the North Pole. We'll be back in a moment.
You You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
So far, we've talked about a referendum, an ultimatum, a court case, and a failing Mexican oil company. It is far beyond time for us to talk about actual war. There was fighting this week in the Caucasus region, a little strip of land in Southeast Europe between the Black and Caspian Seas. This was an area that in the 1990s had a war that killed 20 to 30,000 people, created about 1 million refugees. Recently, we've seen the worst fighting in this region since that war. And to tell us about this, we'll go back to our office in the UK and Richard Palmer.
Yes, the fighting broke out in an enclave called Nagorno-Karabakh. It's one of those frozen conflicts where really there is no simple and straightforward solution. The region is part of Azerbaijan, but currently the vast majority that live there are Armenian, and it's ruled by a separatist government that's supported by Armenia. And there are deeper issues here. The Armenians kicked out of a lot of Azeris from Azerbaijan during the early 90s. So both sides feel very strongly that they should own that region. And as you heard, there was that devastating war in the early 1990s. And this region really brings in a lot of world powers. The Caucasus are vital for Russian defense. It's very close to a lot of their heartland. Stalingrad, one of the most destructive battles in the history of the world. A good part of the fighting around that revolved around who would control the Caucasus. So Russia is very closely watching what's happening here. They back Armenia, but they also have reasonably good relations with Azerbaijan. Turkey, meanwhile, doesn't like the Armenians, so it's aligned with Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan is next to Iran. Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, is an ethnic Azeri. They don't have great relations, but Iran is closely involved and closely monitoring the situation too. And finally, if Europe is going to get natural gas that is not from Russia and end their energy dependence from Russia, much of that gas will probably have to come through the Caucasus and probably come from Azerbaijan. So there's a whole mass of overlaying different interests and competing interests behind the events that are happening here. And in terms of the actual events, starting on Saturday, the ceasefire that has been in place since 1994 that is kind of broken down with the biggest outbreak of fighting since the war ended there. Each side had a bit over a dozen dead, it looks like, with many more wounded. At least one tank was destroyed, a helicopter down. They agreed another ceasefire on Tuesday. That may be breaking down already this morning. Both sides accused the other of breaking the ceasefire over 100 times. So that's some background in the specific events that are going on there.
So you gave us a bit of an idea of why this region is so strategically important. Andrew, maybe you could give us a little more background on that.
Right. I mean, just besides the catastrophic humanitarian crisis this presents, I mean, it really is important in the bigger picture for geopolitics as well. I'd mentioned earlier with Vladimir Putin's Russia using the Orthodox Church to cement his empire. And Armenia is a perfect example of that. They are a member of the Eurasian Union, which is it's an economic union kind of based off a similar concept to the European Union, centered around Russia and including Belarus and Kazakhstan and Armenia and a few others. So they are very economically tied to Russia, but they're also it's a very Orthodox Christian nation, different branch than the Russian Orthodox Church, but still closely tied. So there's an ideological connection there. So Russia definitely does back Armenia. And as Richard said, there is a religious difference between the Russians and the Azerbaijanis. They're Shiite Islam. But Russia still sells a lot of arms to Azerbaijan, and they've tried to keep good relations with them. So in a way, this is almost really, because since Russia's and Turkey's relationship's not so great right now, a competition for those oil fields and pipelines and other things that the Azerbaijanis can provide. Turkey's come down very strong saying we will support Azerbaijan, while Russia's more trying to maybe take more like a mediator role, like says, hey, we're friends with Azerbaijan and we're friends with Armenia. We just want the fighting to stop. The Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church, actually, he's already offered to provide a mediator role if they're willing to accept it, to try to get this conflict to calm down and keep Azerbaijan in Russia's sphere of influence.
Right. The headline in the Daily Beast on this subject said, in Nagorno-Karabakh, a bloody new war with Putin on both sides.
Yeah, I think what's happening I mean, it's a bit early to get a read on it, but I think what's happening is basically Azerbaijan is kind of playing grandmother's footsteps here.
Grandmother's footsteps. You're going to have to explain what grandmother's footsteps is, Richard.
You don't play grandmother's footsteps in America?
No, we do not.
I've never heard of it.
Huh. It's like a kid's game. One kid stands against the wall. He has his back turned to everybody else, and everybody else tries to creep up on him, and whenever the kid turns around...
Red light, green light, or something like that?
Red light, green light.
Like red light, green light, except every time he hears a noise, he turns around, and everybody has to be stationary when he looks.
Oh, yeah.
So Azerbaijan has a much stronger military than Armenia. So every time Russia's back is turned, because there's been a history of minor skirmishes here over the past few months and years. So every time Russia's back is turned, Armenia kind of moves forward as fast as they can. And then when Russia looks their way, they kind of stop and look innocent. Because they can beat the Armenian military, but they can't beat the Russian military. So I think they're trying to push get as much as they can without triggering Russian involvement. And I think this, as they say it, would be the perfect time for that. Russia is under sanctions that are probably going to start winding down soon. They're involved in two conflicts in Chechnya, just north of that area, that's also full of Muslims, is at a point where Russia needs to be a little bit careful, or there could be another outbreak of instability there. And then with the increased tensions between Russia and Turkey, they're likely to get more support from Turkey than usually is the case. So I think they're trying to take advantage of Russian attention being drawn in quite a few different directions to grab some territory in a limited war.
Well, we'll keep our eyes on that situation. Thank you, gentlemen, for telling us about that. Thank you, Richard, for introducing us to Grandmother's Footsteps. We'll have to give that a try. We'll go now to the Arabian Sea nearby for at least the third time in 2 months. The U.S. Navy confiscated a cache of weapons that it believes was being transported to Houthi rebels in Yemen. We'll go back to Brent Noctegal in Jerusalem to reveal the mystery source of this weaponry.
That's right. It wasn't so much of a mystery at the top there. I'm sure everybody realized that this cache of weapons was coming from Iran. And it is interesting. I mean, the nuclear deal has just been struck. We were wondering, people thought, well, what's Iran going to do with the money? And if we needed more evidence that Iran was going to use some of those funds at least to continue destabilizing the Middle East, that's what we see here with this shipment. Now, this shipment was found on March 28, and it had 1,500 Kalashnikov rifles, 200 rocket-propelled grenade launchers, and some other machine guns. And this was, like you said, the third of similar type of Iranian weapons or weapons from Iran that were being sent to the northern part of Yemen to the Houthis. The other one was captured by the HMAS Darwin, the Australian ship there. And then another one was captured by another American ship. Now, in the past 6 months, there has been four shipments that have been found to be going towards the Houthis. And three of those are post-nuclear deal. So instead of slowing their support for terrorism around the world, they're obviously increasing that to the point that the Americans are saying, yeah, it's coming from Iran, and they're definitely supporting the Houthis. Now, this is kind of important because back in 2014, when the Houthis took over the capital of Yemen, booting out the American-backed government from Sana'a, we had the United States that were kind of vague about whether the Iranians were supplying the Houthis or mobilizing the Houthis to do this. We're not really sure if they're doing it. Now they come out and say, well, yeah, the Iranians are doing that. And yet, this is the same time that what's been the headlines for the last couple of weeks, that it looks like the Iranians are going to get access to United States dollars once sanctions are removed. And Secretary of State was questioned about this just yesterday on an American talk show, and just talking, and they asked him, well, is it right that you're working hard to ensure that financial institutions allow Iran access to American dollars while they are supporting terrorism so overtly? And he said, Senator Kerry said, well, Secretary of State Kerry said that, well, we've just got to honor the agreement. We've got to, they're doing what they said they were going to do as far as a nuclear their nuclear ability goes, so there we've got to give them access to the dollars. Like the United States feels that it has to obey by what it said now, when it comes out in Iran's favor, when we've seen them over and over and over again back down, forget about red lines, when it is against Iranian interest.
very quickly, Brent, before we move on to the next story, could you just put this in context strategically from Iran's perspective? Yemen, obviously a really strategically important area in terms of controlling the Red Sea, controlling those oil routes that are managing it, or our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has drawn so much attention to, and Iran trying to really get a chokehold over those points. Maybe you could just put it in that context.
Yeah, well, we have talked about, and the editor-in-chief of the magazine, thetrumpet.com, and the Philadelphia Trumpet, he said back in 2011, before the Arab Spring really took over, that Iran had a strategy to dominate the sea lane all the way from Iran, the Straits of Hormuz, through the Indian Ocean there, up to through the Red Sea and into the southern Mediterranean. And that's what we're seeing. They're not giving up on this goal. In fact, I would say they're probably increasing their efforts to try and dominate this sea lane. And Yemen is right on the Bab el-Mandab Strait, the entrance to the southern entrance to the Red Sea. And if they can control Yemen, they can easily, maybe not easily, but it'll make it easier for them to control the flow of goods, of seaborne goods, through the Suez Canal further up into Egypt. And that's what we expect to play out, them to try and take over and influence more of these countries along the Red Sea corridor, and they're starting that with Yemen.
Thank you, Brent. You are listening to the Trumpet Hour Week in Review. While we're on the subject of war and weaponry and militarization, we're going to travel north, way north, to look at how the North Pole itself is getting military upgrades. For this story, we'll turn it over to Andrew.
Thank you. Well, things are really heating up at the North Pole, and it has nothing to do with global warming. The Russian Defense Ministry has announced that it's about 97% complete with the world's furthest north military base, called the Trefoil Military Base. It's based in the Franz Josef Islands, which is above the 80th parallel, which means that in the wintertime there's going to be several weeks where the sun does not even rise. And so they're fully equipping this with food and other systems for 150 soldiers to live there for as long as 18 months at a time.
So what's the purpose of Russia doing this?
Right. Well, the defense ministry has admitted that there is no short-term military threats to the Russians in the Arctic, but they're taking the long-term goal and really trying to this isn't the only military base. They have been building several military bases, bringing in a lot of advanced weaponry to lock down their control of the Arctic Ocean, because it's estimated that about 15% of the world's untapped oil reserves are in underneath the North Sea ice. Right now, that might not be a big thing because we already have an access 3 million barrels of oil, but eventually we're going to burn through that reserve, and as oil, we'll need more oil supplies, and a few decades in the future, the Arctic might be a major source of the global energy reserves, and Russia wants to make sure that they're ahead of the game and locking down that source.
So there are obviously a lot of countries that claim portions of the Arctic Circle in that territory. Russia is basically saying, no, it's ours. Is it purely an energy grab, or are there more strategic concerns as well?
It is largely an energy grab, but they're also thinking that they're, at least in the summertime when the ice has melted, you can move shipping lanes above the north part of Russia. And that is really a big part for both Russia and China. I mean, for 202 years, the English-speaking peoples have controlled the world's global trade routes. And now China's turned the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean both into almost a Chinese lake, just trying to lock down that source of world trade. And Russia's really trying to do something very similar by locking down the Arctic passage. If you try to get up north of Asia and bring in trade that way, they definitely want to control that as well.
All right, more evidence of Russian territory grabs. I don't suppose that there's too big of a population that is concerned about it up there, but definitely more strategic implications that we need to keep our eyes on. Thanks for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We're going to conclude with an economic story. American college students have $1.2 trillion in student debt, but making this crisis far worse is the fact that a whole lot of these former students have stopped making payments. To tell us about this, we're going to turn to Robert.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal had a report this week, and in that report, they highlighted a pretty disturbing trend. They said that more than 40% of these student borrowers aren't making payments. So as you mentioned, there's $1.2 trillion worth of student loans outstanding. And now above 40% of these students who have borrowed money aren't paying it. Now, these are students that have left college primarily, so they're no longer in college. They're either in the workforce working or they're not working because they can't get a job. And between those two groups, 43% of them, roughly 22 million Americans that have borrowed money are not paying. They're not making payments or they're behind on their payments. So this is a huge chunk of outstanding loans that are in some stage of default. Somebody isn't going to get paid this money. But there's some good news. The good news is that the government's going to make this better. The government that created this problem is going to make this better. If you want to go back and look at the cause, the reason why, you know, the average loan out there for a college student is $25,000. That's what an average college graduate leaves with, $25,000. You can really trace that problem all the way back to George W. Bush's term in government. If you recall back then, he made it illegal for students to discharge that debt in bankruptcy court. It was basically the only debt, the only money you can borrow out there. Go bankrupt, ask a bankruptcy judge, relieve me of this burden, and by law, it cannot be discharged. And the consequence of this was probably the complete opposite of what some people thought. They thought, okay.
Well, the intent was what?
Well, borrowers would realize this and make sure they took out better loans. But in reality, what happened was all the lenders out there saw this as, wow, now we have this vast market of people that cannot discharge this debt. They'll be indebted to us for life. So we don't have to worry about whether or not they can really have a good chance of paying it back. We don't have to worry about if they're going to college for an art degree or whatever degree where there's a low probability that they'll be able to pay back.
Quote unquote guaranteed return.
Right, exactly. And so since that time, we've just seen a balloon in student loan lending. And we've seen a huge increase in the number of students going to college at the same time. But the question is, should these students be going to college? The lenders don't care if they barely made it through high school, if they have the skills required to even be successful at college.
Well, quickly, what are the implications of that much unpaid debt?
Absolutely. We're seeing that right now. There's a lot of talk just about how students are not forming households anymore. They are not getting married. They are not starting families. They are delaying that. They're putting that off. You know, they're not going out there buying the family home. There's a lot of economic implications that just flow through from the fact that these students are burdened down by excessive amounts of debt, and they're working jobs in many of these cases that are never going to let them pay it. They're debt slaves for life.
Well, thanks for that, Robert. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly. This is our weekly news report. The stories that we've talked about on the program are in this week's edition. We'll finish the program next with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. Stay tuned.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. Let's take one last look at some of the headlines from the week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Robert.
Well, great news. The Tax Foundation, which is best known for publishing its tax freedom date, that date upon which Americans will have earned enough money to pay their yearly taxes. So if you were to work and contribute 100% of your gross income, how many days would it take you to earn enough money to pay your yearly taxes? And good news, Americans will only need to work to April 24th this year to earn enough money to pay all their taxes. That's good news because last year they had to work to April 25th, so one day less. The downside, the bad news, is that Americans will pay $3.3 trillion in federal taxes, plus an additional $1.6 trillion in state and local taxes, working out to about 31% of the nation's income. That's more than they'll spend on food, clothing, and housing combined.
All right, over to Richard.
Arms spending data published this week by SIPRI shows that arms spending is rocketing in Eastern Europe. Polish spending up 33%, Romanian 22%, budgeted to go up by 53% this year, Slovakia up 17%, Lithuania up 33%, Latvia 14%. So these are very significant percentage increases. And then the UK, France, and Germany are also raising their spending, but by much less dramatic percentages.
Is Vladimir Putin getting a cut of any of that arms spending? Let's go now to Andrew.
Well, lo and behold, China's finally announced this week that they're going to put some sanctions on North Korea to rein in its nuclear program. For years, China's used North Korea almost like its little attack dog to cause trouble for America by financing their economy and then giving them plausible deniability that they hold any responsibility. But now they're cutting back North Korea's coal and rare earth mineral shipments in allegedly an attempt to rein back this nuclear program. Now, it's been pointed out that they've said this has been done before, and they've oftentimes just given them funding under the table, so it's a little early to know if they're for real. But this could be the first sign that Kim Jong-un's uppityness is starting to finally tick off Beijing.
All right, we'll go now to Brent.
According to a CNN report released this week, the Obama administration is examining the relocation of U.S. international peacekeeping troops that are currently in a base in the northern Sinai Peninsula. Now, apparently, the fighting there is getting too dangerous, or ISIS is becoming stronger and stronger in the Sinai Peninsula, to the point that the United States is thinking about removing their contingent from that very strategically important area.
And back over to Richard.
Greece's economic crisis is back in the news thanks to some leaked documents from the IMF. At a recent meeting, a couple of IMF representatives, officials, were complaining that Greece wasn't doing enough to reform. And they said that if Greece gets pressured enough, then they might start making the changes that the IMF wanted, implying that the IMF wants the Greek crisis to get worse so that the Greeks will be more compliant. This has caused a big uproar within Greece and makes the whole political debate around this much more rancorous and could make the crisis flare up again, potentially.
All right, back to Andrew.
Well, the Panama Papers is big news here in America, revealing how several world leaders have been caught using offshore bank accounts down in a company through Panama. It's not such big news in Russia or China. Apparently, the Russians have been really downplaying it, saying that nothing's been proven, and neither Putin nor any of his men have conclusively been implicated. And the Chinese have taken it a step further and pretty much just censored the internet and make sure none of their people even know there is such a thing as the Panama Papers.
All right, we'll go back to Brent.
In a meeting in Tel Aviv on Wednesday, Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yoalon, he told his Polish counterpart that hundreds of jihadists are planning to strike Western targets on European soil, and they are already on the continent. And this comes from a man that knows what he's talking about. He's head of the Israeli, he's the defense minister of Israel. He'll understand the travelings of ISIS. And he's saying there are hundreds already planning to do more attacks similar to what we saw in Paris and Brussels. He called those attacks just the start.
And we'll finish with Robert.
Well, good news if you're a Venezuelan worker, or sort of good news. During a televised state appearance earlier this week, Venezuela's president announced that Venezuelans will get to take Friday off for the next 2 months. Each and every Friday, they get off. It's in a bid to save electricity. So although this sounds like a great thing, unfortunately, the workers will have to experience that Friday as a Friday without electricity. This is to save electricity in a nation that can no longer produce it because all of its electricity, or a large portion of it, 7%, comes from one dam.
Wait, how much?
70% comes from one dam, and that dam is dry.
Government-owned dam.
Government-owned monopoly.
You gotta love it. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly. That's our weekly news report that's packed with all of the stories that you heard about on the program today. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Robert Morley, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
You're welcome.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with the words of Mark Twain. It is better to deserve honors and not have them than to have them and not deserve them. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.